Hello and welcome to the SEAI's 180 Degrees podcast. I'm your host, Sinead Ryan, and over the course of the next 12 episodes, I'll be joined by special guests to talk about the state of play of Ireland's energy revolution, how we can be smarter energy users, what renewable technologies are coming into our homes and communities, and how small businesses can benefit from decarbonising now. Every year, the SEAI publishes the Energy in Ireland report. It presents energy statistics on production and consumption in Ireland. The report looks at energy trends, the consumption by each sector, transport, residential, business and aviation and all of those things, but also looks at cost competitiveness and energy security, which are really increasingly important things in Ireland today, especially as we progress through our EU renewable targets. Now, to talk us through the report and what's in it and what's to come, I'm delighted to be joined by Margie McCarthy, Director of Research and Policy Insights at SEAI. Hello, Margie.
Hi.
And Dr. Lee Carroll, Programme Manager for Energy Statistics at SEAI. You're both very welcome along. Now, Lee, you're the boffin here. You're the number cruncher.
That's it.
The bean counter. So give us an idea about why this data is important before we get into what the report for this year actually tells us. What do we measure? Why do we do it?
So the Energy in Ireland report really is the flagship output from the stats team in SEAI. And it's a true farm-to-fork assessment of energy in Ireland. So we look at where it's coming from, where it's going, and how it's used. And that's really a unique selling point of the report. It really gives this genuine, holistic overview of how energy in Ireland is used.
Does every country in the EU do this, and are they all done to the same standard?
So every country in the EU needs to submit data to Eurostat, which is like the central statistics office in Europe, and it all needs to be in a similar format so that they can do longitudinal analysis. But not every country, I guess, puts in the effort to prepare in this kind of narrative-based, very accessible and understandable format.
So that means that we have a real chance here of looking at what other countries and member states are doing in this space. Does it also feed in maybe to a wider global set of numbers as well?
Yeah, there's a real hierarchy there. So Ireland is one member state in Europe, and then, you know, Europe is one continent in the world. So, I mean, I guess we've recently been hearing a lot about COP28. So Ireland, you know, contributes indirectly its data through Eurostat and into the International Energy Agency statistics as well.
Okay, well, that said, so it's a valuable report and it's up to date. So give us an idea then, what are the headline issues that came out of the 2023? It's only just published.
That's right.
So it's fresh in your mind, hopefully. Tell us a little bit about what's in it, what we should know.
So really, I guess what the report does is it helps quantify things we already know to be true, but it also throws some kind of surprising and insightful messages out there as well. So really, this year, what it highlighted was how import dependent we are in energy. So approximately 82% of Ireland's energy supply comes from imports. And it also highlights how fossil dependent we are. So 86% of Ireland's energy supply also comes from fossil fuels. So those are really kind of confirmations, I guess, of really what we already know.
They're kind of slightly depressing numbers, it would seem to me, because I think a lot of listeners might have hoped we'd have been further along that journey at this stage. Margie, what does that tell us about policy making and that big yawning gap that we still have to close?
So what Lee's spoken about, actually, energy in Ireland gives us that kind of summation of where we're at today, what fuels we're using. As Lee said, we're very dependent on fossils and imports. Another piece of work that we do is projections as well. So we have a large modelling capacity within SEAI. And what that does is it takes all of the information that's produced on the Energy in Ireland report and then looks at all the various policies that are in place. What policies and measures have we listed out in things like our climate action plan? Where have we set our targets to on the carbon budgets? And then models all of that to tell us where we're going to land by. At the moment, our milestones are kind of 2025 and 2030, obviously looking out to 2050 to be net zero by then. But it models out to 2030 to see, okay, where are we landing by comparison with the targets? Mm-hmm. And we are at the moment showing that there will be a gap in the energy projections towards what we need to have done by 2030 with our carbon budget. So what it's telling us is We've had some signals of good news around some aspects of what we're trying to do as a society and an economy. We've seen upticks on electric vehicles, for example. We have definitely seen momentum in people making their homes more efficient, making them cozier, insulating them so they're using less energy. You know, we're one of the leaders in terms of deploying wind onto our electricity grid. So there are signals of good things. But we have to catch up pretty quickly, and we have to move quicker. That's, I suppose, the overriding message is action today is what counts. And there are a whole load of things there around policy supports and also people's actions and decisions.
Okay, and we'll get on to the particular sectors and individual things that we can do in a little bit. But I just want to explore a little bit further. 2023 will be remembered, unfortunately, as the year where, say, the war in Ukraine continued, where supplies, which were very worrisome the previous year, of course, we didn't even know if we would continue to have supplies with Russia and all that. That has continued, but it seems to have stabilised somewhat. Whereabouts do we now get, say, our oil and our gas and electricity supplies from?
So the gas is an easy one to answer. So we import about 75% of our gas supply, and it comes through two international interconnectors that connect us to Scotland. So if you imagine a kind of a cooker at home, a four-hob cooker, if you turn them all on, like one of those hobs is being powered by Irish gas, and the other three rings are being fired by imported gas from Scotland.
Is it via Scotland or from Scotland?
It's from, I guess, the UK's network. Yeah. So it's really just kind of an accident of geography that it's being piped across from Scotland, kind of nearest point of access.
Right. And in terms of oil, of course, we don't produce any of that ourselves, and we know where that comes from. Were either of you or both of you reassured by any of the outcomes of COP28?
Yeah, well, look, it's always good to be on the hopeful side of things, isn't it? Especially when it comes to climate action, because we have such a challenge ahead of us. I think the wording transition away is a baseline. And actually, I think the way in which we go about COP and the negotiations there has to be considered a baseline rather than the ambition and where we should be aiming for. So what I mean by that is, we couldn't get phase out or phase down of fossil fuels. We got transition away. The COP negotiations is the only place where we currently have the ability to bring all of the various actors, whether you're in a petrostate, whether you're in a very progressive on renewables state, to come to the one table and come to an agreement. That's always going to be difficult. It's very hard to get people, we were saying recently, to pick a movie if you're sitting in on a movie night, never mind trying to figure out how you're going to make these massive changes on dependence. As Lee said, the Energy in Ireland report is telling us how dependent we are here in this country on fossils, even though we don't tend to produce them in any way. We don't have that natural resource here. So on COP, I think, look, it's great that it finally has a reference in there, but everyone needs to go back to their home state, home country, and do better than what we have agreed to in COP. It has to be more than that. And actually, in Ireland, we have very ambitious targets. We're really stretching ourselves in terms of how we're going to be more efficient and also how we're going to deploy renewables. But how we get there is really important. And as I've said already, pace is
and when.
Critical.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, Lee, let's look at then some of the culprits closer to home, because there's very little we can do about oil prices, oil supply, you know, the gas stuff. That's kind of the umbrella end of things. When it comes to looking at the culprits, as I said, people like to think of or blame the airline industry, cattle on farms, the big data centres we seem to love so much. Give us some background to where we can throw our hat at those sectors.
Yeah, well, I guess it's useful to have some numbers to quantify these things, but perhaps quantifying is a better word than blaming people. But so broadly speaking, 38% of Ireland's greenhouse emissions come from the agricultural sector. Mm. So it's by far the single largest sector. Agriculture accounts for twice as many emissions as the transport sector, which is the next biggest emitter.
Gosh, that might surprise a lot of people.
Yeah, it's an interesting statistic. So in Ireland, we have 7 million cows and 6 million sheep, and we've about 5 million people. So if you kind of, if you're walking around the street, if you can imagine you've kind of got a virtual cow and a virtual sheep following you around all the time, that's what really contributes significantly to our per capita emissions. So you'll often hear it cited that we have very high per capita emissions compared to Europe. And that's really because a lot of our emissions aren't coming on a per capita basis. They're coming from people, but they're also coming from the significant livestock populations we have on the island.
Okay, and that's always going to be a hard one to square in an agricultural country that we have been and that we are, and certainly that farm families play such a big role in Ireland. So it is difficult. So perhaps there is, you know, a 38%, that would seem to me, Margie, to force a policy conversation around our food intake, food production, and the type of exports that maybe we should be focusing on, perhaps?
Well, I think it's when you look at the next couple of sectors. So that's agriculture, and energy is responsible for about 60% of our emissions. I think people will be very aware of the headlines around the difficulty in reducing the emissions in agriculture. That is going to be a kind of a step change in the way things are done in that sector.
Do you think it's moving fast enough?
I don't think any of it's moving fast enough, unfortunately. That's the thing. Yeah. But what we've done in our carbon budget, so these are the budgets that we've set ourselves. I think sometimes it's really important to get these across to people, because I always find, for me, it's like when you set yourself, let's say, a monthly budget with what you earn, your income, and you have certain amount that you can spend within that month, and you have to make it last the 4 weeks. You can't just blast it all in the first week and have nothing to spend in the rest. And what you have to think about in the carbon budgets is actually it's very similar. There's an amount that a sector can afford to release in terms of carbon. And if you overspend in the first couple of years, you have to compensate in the other years. And that makes it extremely difficult, because you were already going to be constrained, right? So what we've done in the carbon budgets is we've made it sectoral. And in agriculture, we have set a limit of 25% reduction in emissions by 2030. In transport, which is the next biggest emitter, there's a 50% reduction by 2030. But electricity, which is our third, there's a whopping 75%. And why? It's because we have an established route to be able to decarbonize. We've been very successful in getting to a kind of 40% renewable electricity stage. And our ambition is to get to 80% by 2030. So there's loads of challenges to doing that, loads of things around making sure we have infrastructure, ports are ready, we have the right grant systems, we have the right supports for developers, etc. We've involved communities, so they're supportive in terms of achieving that. But it's still setting, I suppose, a tiering system of where the policies are already established and action is already happening. And agriculture, obviously, at 25% is less of a stretch out to 2030, I think, to recognise the change.
Some listeners might recall that in the last episode we spoke about EVs and the surge in that and the grants and all the things that are available. And it was really, really interesting. So I would encourage people to listen back to that if they missed it. In the next episode, we will be focusing on transport specifically. And if that's the second largest element in our output, Lee, that's something that we can all play a part in. But when it comes to transport within that sector, is it cars? Is it the aviation industry? Is it public transport? Where is the breakdown there?
So about half of all energy and emissions in transport come from private car use. So private car use is a very significant contributor. So the international aviation is an interesting one. So if you sum up the amount of emissions and energy we have on the roads and rail, it's about five times higher than what we have in international aviation. So really, there's a huge opportunity to save emissions on the road, so on the ground, so to speak, as well as in the air.
So it would seem curious then that perhaps the government has chosen this time to phase out the grants for things like EV cars and maybe not push them as much, because it's that thing between the carrot and stick, isn't it, always with this argument. And we should all be doing the right thing, and then consumers say, oh, it's so expensive to buy an EV car and I don't want to do it. And tweaking that policy constantly must create a tension between that set of scales, Margie.
suppose it's a keeping an eye on what's working in the market and where support is most needed. And I know the transport policy is around this idea of avoid, shift and improve. So the biggest change that people can take on is actually getting out of the car in the first place. That is ultimately where we have to go. It should really be through active mobility. If you're able to walk and you're able to cycle, great, do that. It does take changing how you plan your day and what you're going to have to carry in your bag, etc. But then it's about shift, so getting to public transport. And if you're not able, so let's say you're in a very rural area or your mobility is restricted, then that's where the car decision should come into play. And I suppose government investment has to, one, it's looking at the infrastructure for charging. So that's one of the challenges for EVs. And we've been seeing massive improvements in that, and that will need to continue. So that's where it's being directed. And then also the infrastructure around public transport and making our kind of areas safer for people to be actively mobile.
And we're seeing a lot of that. Okay, well, as I say, we're going to focus on that as a key issue next episode. So we leave that there. Now, the other thing you mentioned, of course, in terms of the usage was the energy itself. Now, are we talking, Lee, about is the data center to blame or is it my house and my usage?
So if you're talking about electricity, so maybe it's good to kind of put in reference that about 26% of Ireland's energy is electricity. So, you know, 70 odd percent is non-electricity. So people do have a tendency to focus, zoom in on electricity. So within the specifics of electricity, yes, data centers do consume a significant amount. The CSO have indicated recently that in 2022, 18% of all of Ireland's electricity supply goes to satisfying the demands of data centers. So it's a significant fraction.
Do you think that there's then a kind of a hypocrisy about being asked to individually turn off our heating and not use tumble dryers and be careful about, you know, all the electrical appliances and the vampire energy and all of that, and yet give then permissions to these giant buildings, you know, which are generating, maybe only have 10 employees, but they're absolutely generating a ton of electricity. It's like people might just see that as not really the right approach.
I think maybe in the context of energy in Ireland, we're interested in putting kind of honest, unambiguous numbers out there to fuel discussions like that. So it's not that the statistics team would take a position. We just want good data out there that can help inform kind of evidence-based discussions.
Yeah, and I mean, having those numbers is important because in some ways it kind of dampens down maybe the people who be saying it's all the data centres and it's all the planes in the sky, and then, you know, the numbers show otherwise. In terms of policy though, Margie, it does sometimes look as if it's a little bit skewed the wrong way.
I think what's really important here is everybody's action counts in the climate pathway to net zero. So we often, even you mentioned COP a minute ago, there's often this thing, if Ireland did everything and achieved all of its ambitions, would it make a jot of difference? But actually about 40% of our emissions across the world is due to small nations like ourselves. So if we all didn't do our part, it would be a major issue for the global equation of reduction. At home, yes, government has to get policies and supports right. Industry and commercial businesses have to do their part as well. But interestingly, from the Energy in Ireland report, what it tells us is about 45% of the emissions are in relation to our personal journey. So how we move about in cars that are mostly fueled by petrol and diesel. And the electricity and heat that we use in our home, predominantly heat. Electricity is about a quarter of the energy we'll use in our homes. The rest is heat. And again, predominantly fossil.
All right. Well, having put me back in my box then, let's look at what we can all do on a micro level. Because at the end of the day, for everybody listening, that's really all that we have charge of, our personal responsibility and the small things that we can do. You mentioned heat. Now, I understand from the SEAI's website, which is very good and worth going on, that most of the energy consumption in appliances, say in the home, goes on heating things. So whether that's the dreaded immersion or the tumble dryer or putting on the dishwasher, the washing machine, it's heating the water is the key thing, isn't it? So we can't avoid that. So what is the kind of the small advice on a micro level for us to do it better? Is it, you know, doing things at a cooler temperature for longer or getting it over with at a really high temperature?
Well, and actually we had a really great campaign called Reduce Your Use yes. that people can tune into as well. So there's varying things you can do. There are the simple, I won't say simple because it is dependent on your own home and your own lifestyle and your own needs, right? But reducing your temperature, if you have heating controls in your home, reducing it by a degree, trying 2 degrees, see what you're comfortable with. Obviously, if you've health issues and you need warmer, it's about making sure that everyone in society is staying warm. But you'd be surprised how you can survive with maybe an extra layer as a jumper or something within your home and how much energy you can
save. And I'd say you're one of those people a bit like me. When your granny used to say yeah. that to you, you'd be saying, oh no. So it's really about heating the person rather than heating the home. Isn't that it?
And granny got it right a yeah. lot, you know. So and just being aware of appliances, tumble dryers, are they really necessary? Yeah. Use it only when absolutely necessary. And we'd really advise try not to use it at all.
In fact, it's yeah. not great for the old clothes either, you know, no. if you can help it. Nudgenomics is a kind of buzzword among behavioural economists, Lee. And their sense of it is that, okay, price is a big influencer because none of us want to have to pay for this stuff. Do you think that in one way, the current cost of living crisis, which is ongoing in many, many households, has kind of nudged people towards doing the right thing inadvertently?
I think it's made people more aware of that energy has a cost and that, like, you know, flicking on the light switch, turning on the tumble dryer or, you know, cranking up the heating, you know, has a financial cost to the individual or the household. And that's, you know, while nobody should be lumped with very high costs, it's a good thing that people are aware that there's a cost associated with the use of energy. But as Margie said, there's been rather successful campaigns on reduce your use. And there's just statistics out there that if you reduce the house temperature by 1 degree, you can save 10% of your heating bills. So that's a 10% saving in your pocket and then a 10% saving as opposed to the planet in terms of the emissions. So even some fairly moderate changes in behavior can lead to lower costs and lower emissions. But I would never estimate the challenge of making a small change to one's behaviour.
Indeed, indeed. And look, what would you say to, you know, people out there who are genuinely trying to do their best? They're saying, look, I'm recycling into the 7 bins I have outside. You know, I'm taking the bus. I don't buy fast fashion. But my foreign holiday every year is sacrosanct. And, you know, I can't do it without the car at weekends. Is it just about that balance? Because, you know, there's no point beating yourself up over a lot of this stuff.
I think the really important thing, and we've seen that in, for example, when the situation in the Ukraine and the energy prices soar, it's about being considerate of your actions. So some things you may not be able to change today. Maybe you could start planning for them. Maybe a home energy upgrade is something that you could do in the near future, maybe not tomorrow, but you could reduce the thermostat by 1 degree. So there's what will work for you today, but it really is about having presence of mind to consider these things. And if, for example, you have to use the car for certain things, can you use the public transport or the bike in other days?
Just thinking beyond it.
All of those things add up. They really do. And one thing we have seen, because we do a lot of behavioural studies as well. We look at, you know, how different factors influence the way in which we behave. And one of the things that's really powerful is knowing that what you're doing is contributing as well as other people are doing their part too. So this idea of collective action, and that's what's really important that we're seeing in the Energy in Ireland report. We're beginning to see people coming together and taking actions that are actually impacting and making a difference.
So. And maybe then we'll get to the stage where, you know, not doing certain things or being seen to be wasteful or overly energy usage will become a bit of a prior, a bit like the plastic bag or the smoking or whatever. Do you think then, to kind of finish on a positive note, that there is a great deal of hope for the next generation? So these are school-going kids who are recycling in school. They may have a green flag in their playground. They're growing up with this as the norm. Would that give us hope, do we think, as both parents and the generation that is leaving this legacy behind us?
I think Ireland is putting in the hard yards now. Like, we are kind of living through this energy transition to having a more sustainable energy framework. And so the next generation will benefit from that, that they will grow up in a country that has much better energy security, much more sustainable energy and much more lower emissions. And I guess that's what motivates a lot of people, including myself, is that, like, it's challenging for us now, but it will be better for future generations coming down the line.
Yeah. And Margie, you'd agree with that?
I would. And I think what's there's fantastic momentum amongst young people for climate action. And what I think, and they really know it and feel it. I think what's really important for us as the adults of today is to, I love that phrase, you know, about being great ancestors and really looking after the decisions. And as Lee said, we have to do things now so that we are creating a world that these guys can thrive in. It's going to be a part on both of our sides, but I have great hope for the future generation. I just think, and they really are kind of pushing us to do the right
Aren't
thing.
Aren't they just yeah, smart right. and committed and maybe giving out to us when we do it badly because they know the right way. All right. Well, listen, keep it up, kids. and that's all we have for today. So we leave it there. My thanks to Margie and Lee today for contributing all of that and breaking down the Energy in Ireland data. That's now published. So anybody can go and have a look at it. Margie, where can they find it?
On the SEI website, sei.ie. And the projections report that we also mentioned is also available at that
All
site.
Right. So that'll both frighten you and give you reassurance at exactly the same time. There you go. So tune in next week. We'll have a mini episode where I'll be grilling Margie on some of the key elements around this and the most frequently asked questions that the SEAI gets on this very topic. See you next time. If you've enjoyed this episode of the 180 Degrees podcast, well then why not review and subscribe to it now? And of course, share it with family and friends to find out more about renewables and energy. Well then, check out seai.ie.